So, lovely. Roger, thank you very much for that. Thomas, where's Thomas? Thank you for organizing this great conference. And Christian, thank you for setting me up, because you've done that. This topic of design of a climate agreement would take me at a minimum probably a full course to discuss, at least as I understand the topic, but I'm gonna focus more sharply on particular aspects of this colossal problem, focusing in particular on what's coming up soon in Paris. This is my representation of the timeline for the climate negotiations. We start in the red area there with a conference that was held, an informal quasi-official conference held in Toronto in 1988. And in this conference, a target was chosen for the entire world to limit CO2 emissions 20% from the 1988 level by 2005. After that, countries started making their own unilateral declarations for what they would do. Many countries did this. And then they decided, well, we can't just do this independently. We need to coordinate what we're doing. We need to solve the collective action problem. So that's when the negotiations started in 1990 on an agreement. And we ended up with a framework convention on climate change, which was supposed to negotiate individual country contributions. I'll use that term now. But they failed to do that, but they did arrive at a collective objective for the entire planet. And then they moved from there to try to negotiate the individual country emission levels, and that was in the Kyoto Protocol from 1997. And from there, the objective was to strengthen and broaden the Kyoto Protocol going into Copenhagen. And of course, what happened there was collapse and a sort of recovery, where countries then decided they would move off more in a voluntary direction. So that to the left, you spin off to something called the Doha Amendment, which is basically a rump agreement that's the splinter. It's the leftover part of the Kyoto Protocol, and it's basically in a cul-de-sac. It's going to die off in that territory. But the world's moving now off towards Paris, and the question mark there is we probably will reach an agreement in Paris. The question I wanted to address is, will that agreement make any difference? So Christian was speculating, as a lot of people have, but I'm going to do a little bit of science into whether it's going to make a difference. So to summarize, the approach we've taken so far is to set a collective goal and then to have countries set or negotiate targets and timetables. And we've been trying, this is the very important point, we've been trying the same thing for 25 years. And why we think we're going to get a different outcome every time we reconvene to negotiate this, I don't understand. As Christian said, the entire time we've been negotiating along this approach, emissions globally have gone up, concentrations have continued to go up. So we're not getting a grip on this problem at all. The one thing that seems to be novel about the current effort in Paris is this possibility. It's still early days in terms of the negotiations, but at least the novelty seems to be that there'd be some space, some process for assessment and review. So countries are going to declare what they intend to do, make their pledges, and then we'll see if through a review process, there'd be any maybe indirect, subtle, social almost, pressures for countries to actually fulfill their obligations. So not the kind of harsh top-down, or maybe not top-down, but not the kind of harsh punitive types of actions that Christian was thinking of, although I'm going to come to those later. So I'm really asking the question, will this work? Now, one model that people often have in their minds about this problem is probably appropriately called top-down, and that is you start off with something like a temperature change goal, and then you back out from there a total amount of CO2 that can be put into the atmosphere from now until forever. And then you disaggregate that amongst all the different countries. That's the allocation. But all of this approach has to rest on a foundation of enforcement. And the reason that Kyoto failed fundamentally, I know that there are lots of other reasons associated with it, but fundamentally is it lacked the ability to enforce what was already agreed. There is a collective gain to be had, as Christian emphasized. That's why countries keep coming back to negotiate, but what they've not figured out how to change the incentives so countries actually fulfill the obligations that they know is in their collective interests, but not in their individual interests. This middle part, by the way, that's a constant sum game, and that's the bit that Marty was really emphasizing. There's always conflict in that kind of situation, but I would say the fundamental thing that has been holding us back has been on the enforcement side. Now, Paris, I'm not sure the best way to draw Paris, but it looks something like this. There is a negotiation around a global target. By the way, everyone always agrees on global targets because no one's responsible for them. So that's why they agree on these really quickly. And then now they're coming up with their nationally determined contributions, and these are purely voluntary, so that's why they come up with those. You can see why we're getting what we're getting. In between is where any action that we're interested in is going to come, and that's in this thing called assessment and review. So will Paris make a difference? Well, think about it. How are we going to know? The agreement itself probably won't enter into force until 2020. Even after that, of course, it has to be implemented. That could take a decade or so to find out whether it's really having an impact. And even then, we'll never know, because we never would have known what would have happened without the agreement. We never get to see the counterfactual. And meanwhile, while we're waiting to see if this thing works, emissions are going to keep going, concentrations are going to keep rising, and we will have lost another decade or more. We've already lost 2.5 decades. But we'll lose another decade or more, and then what are we going to do? What kind of bright ideas are we going to come up with there? The main point I want to emphasize is that we can use the tools of basic economics, basically, to answer the question, will the approach that's being proposed for Paris make a difference, yes or no? And what we're doing now is we're flying blindly. There's not a proper scientific approach to the negotiations themselves. There's not a proper scientific approach to the design of the agreements. So I think we can do some experimentation to find out whether this approach will work. Now, the theory of this is really simple. There is no theory, basically, because the assessment and review process is basically a kind of a cheap talk, and the prediction would be that it would make no difference at all. There have been experiments looking into whether this kind of assessment review, naming and shaming, whether it makes any difference or not, and at least the studies that get published, I'm guessing there may be some that don't get published that come up with a different result, but at least the ones that are getting published are finding that it actually can make a difference. So maybe there's a reason for some hope. On the other hand, the context for climate change is really quite different. So I've teamed up with a colleague, Astrid Dannenberg, who's at the University of Kassel and has also been a colleague of Thomas Stirner's at Gothenburg, to do an experiment on Paris and to see whether it'll make a difference. So this is what we're interested in. These are the real negotiations. This is a photo from Copenhagen in 2009. You can see President Obama on the left and other world leaders there. This is how we see it. This is going to be a poker game played with poker chips. I think this particular photo, which I just stole from the web, I hope there are no copyright lawyers here, but I think this particular picture is from a James Bond movie, which I didn't see because I don't get out very much. But that's what we're doing. So this is, it's a bit like, you know, theory is an abstraction of the real world. Well, this is a kind of a play on the real world. So this is the experiment. It's very simple. There are 5 players in every group, and each player starts off with 5 black poker chips and 15 red poker chips. And the black poker chips are cheap. They're worth 10 cents each. And the red poker chips are expensive. They're worth 1 euro each. Any chip contributed by anyone, doesn't matter the color, gives every player 5 cents for a payoff. And if the players contribute too little in total, then each player experiences quite a significant loss of 20 euros. That you can think of as being the loss of crossing a tipping point for climate change. And the value of the threshold, the tipping point itself, is unknown. It's uncertain, but it is known to lie on the between 50 and 100. So if the number of chips contributed is less than 50, every player loses 20 euros with certainty. If the number of chips contributed is exactly 100, then everyone loses nothing. They get to keep all their chips that they hold. And in between, there's some probability. So 75, there's a 50% chance that you'll lose your 20 euros. So the incentives in this game are, of course, very simple. If the group cooperates collectively and does the best they can as a group, they'll avoid a catastrophe and they'll get a payoff of 5 euros each. If the players pursue their self-interest exclusively, then the outcome will be that the threshold will be crossed and the players will lose 4.5 euros. Now, you can't actually have an experiment where you take money away from someone after they've been performing the experiment. So what we did is we gave everyone an endowment fund that nothing they can do can change that fund. But that ensures that when students are coming to play the experiment, they can't be out of pocket. So we give them an endowment fund of 19 euros. And the main point I want to make is this simple game is the Prisoner's Dilemma. You've all seen this game. And what we're trying to see now is whether the assessment and review would make a difference in how this game is played. Now, the worst a player can do is if she gives all her chips and no one else gives any, in which case the payoff would be zero. That's including the 19 euro endowment fund. And the best you could get is that everyone else gives their chips, all of their chips, you give none, and then you're lucky and you don't cross the catastrophic threshold, in which case you get 38 euros 50. The point I'm trying to make here is there's a very large dispersion in the possibilities of the payoffs you can get. And when we actually did the experiment, there were some people, now they're working 2 hours in the laboratory. It's actually very concentrated work. It's actually not easy for them. Some of the students left with 40 cents. They were not happy. I didn't do the experiment. Astrid did the experiment. But they left with 40 cents. They were not happy. And some left with over 30 euros, and they were very happy. And this just emphasizes that this is a high-stakes game we're playing. And the groups, we have 10 different groups for each of the treatments. There'll be four treatments I'll describe. And one, we had a few students that didn't show up. We only had 9 groups, but it doesn't matter. Okay, so this is what it looks like. The students are going to go into these cabins, and they're going to play the game on these computers. And this is the sequence of the game. A little hard to follow, maybe, but what happens is at the very beginning, the students are going to make a proposal for what they think the group ought to do. So that's equivalent sort of to the 2-degree target that countries are debating. It's actually now in the current draft as one of the possibilities for a collective target. And then when the players propose the target, they know that it's the median value that will be chosen by the group. Okay, that's fixed by us. So they make their proposals. From that, we take the median. That's the target for the group. And after that, the individuals make their pledges. And these are all made publicly available after the pledges are made. So everyone gets to see everyone else's pledges. And then in the basic treatment, you go all right from there into the contribution stage. So we're going to play this over 2 stages. So in the first stage, you decide to contribute some number of chips. And then all the chips contributed by everyone are revealed to the entire room. And then you get to do it again. You contribute one last time a certain number of chips. And again, this is displayed to everyone in the room. After that, then Mother Nature plays the game. So I think an important part of the climate change game is that players are playing a game amongst themselves as a group, but the group is playing a game with Mother Nature, and we don't know how she's going to play. We don't know what's going to happen in terms of the scientific uncertainty on tipping and so on. And so we're going to spin a wheel for Mother Nature. I'll show you that in a minute. And then finally, the students are paid the money in cash. Now, that's the no treatment, no review treatment, but then those 3 colored ovals show you the different treatments. We have the review stage. The first is the ex-ante review, and we stick that in after the pledges, but before contributions. The second one's a midterm review, so that's after the first stage of contributions, but before the second. And the final one is after the contributions have been made, but before we know how Mother Nature will play. Okay? And the reason we put that in is because in the early drafts of the Paris Agreement, there were these different ex-ante and strategic review steps. And the grading is done, you grade others in terms of their pledges and or their contributions on a scale from 1 to 6, where 1 is, this is German, 1 is very good, and 6 is insufficient. I think the Americans would have different labels. I think 1 would be like awesome or something, right? It would be different, where, I mean, a lot of hyperbole, as you know. But this is German, so it's more downplayed. Okay, but the students are all familiar with this process, so they were all graded this way in high school. We also try to infer people's expectations for how they think the others are going to play. And we do this by before the players make their contributions, so after they've seen the pledges, they know the targets, we ask a question, how much do you think your co-players will contribute on average? And to give people an incentive to reveal the truth, we give them a reward of €1 for correct guesses. And so now we have some estimate of their expectations for how others will play. This is how nature plays. Remember, we have a uniform distribution from 50 to 100, and we represent it on this wheel, and one of the students volunteers to spin the wheel, and everyone gets to see it on their screen, how it comes out. And this is where nature tells you whether the group contributed enough chips or not. Just to remind you, this is a game people are playing for money, so that it's a reason to take it seriously. We're not just asking hypothetical questions. Okay, here are the results. So what you have in the horizontal axis, the no review was the treatment that was no review. That's the one we're comparing to what we're doing now that's supposed to be different about Paris. And then you have the three different reviews. The ex-ante, so that's before the contribution stage, midpoint in the middle of the contribution, the two contribution stages, and finally ex-post after the contribution stages. And if you look at the chart, you'll see that in every case, the pledges come in below targets and the contributions come in below pledges. See, what we're seeing now is we're seeing negotiation over targets. We're seeing countries submit their intended nationally determined contributions. Those are the pledges. And what we haven't seen yet, of course, are the contributions. So the only thing we're really interested in are the contributions. And what we want to see is if the review process makes a difference. So if you look at those green bars, what you want to know is there a difference in the height of those four bars. You don't see a big difference there. I'm going to come to the statistics in a second. And also notice that where you want everyone to go is to 100. So every group is, every treatment is far below 100. Now, looking at the statistics, if you focus, let's say focusing on the third column there on contributions, you can see that the contributions seem to be higher for the reviews than for the no review, but you also see in the parentheses there that the standard deviations are really high. There's a lot of variation, and if you go to the far right column, we show the minimum and maximum number of chips contributed by the groups within each treatment, and you can see there's a lot of variation. This is actually part of the story I'm going to come to later on. On the left here, we get to look at the significance here of the difference. And if you look on the target, you'll see for ex-ante and ex-post review, compared to no review, because those top values are so small, we have statistical significance. So the review stages make a difference in terms of the collective target. If you go to the next column, the pledges, the same thing, that Okay, same thing here. You have significance here in terms of the pledge being higher with the ex-ante review and with ex-post review, a little milder here with midpoint. In terms of contributions, though, no significance at all. Okay? So it's making it, the review process makes a difference in what people say, but not in terms of what they do, which is what we're interested in. Now we're doing some regressions to try to explain what's going on. And the first one here, looking at what determines the proposal. And what you see is that the existence of the review process improves proposals for these two different treatments. It also improves pledges, but not directly. There's no direct effect of the review process at all. But pledges are higher if the target is higher, and the targets are higher if there's a review process. So there's a very indirect channel in terms of pledges being affected by the review process. And here we're looking at the contributions, which is what we really care about. And again, the review process has no direct effect at all. It does have an indirect effect because contributions are higher. My contribution is higher when my pledge is higher. On top of that, my contribution is higher when I believe that my co-players are going to contribute. Okay? And we know that my pledge is higher because the target's higher, and the target's higher because of the review process. So there's a very indirect effect of the review process in terms of contributions. But in the end, of course, we don't have statistical significance for the effect of the review process on contributions. And then finally here, this is a regression of the effect of people's expectations of how their co-players will play, and again, not affected at all by the review process, is affected by their pledges, and their pledges are affected indirectly by the review process. So the basic conclusions here are that the review process causes the players to set a higher target. The higher target causes players to raise their pledges, but through this long chain of behavior, it has no effect at all on contributions. And the other point to make is that contributions are well below the full cooperative level. Now, the other result we have is this tremendous variation in behavior amongst the different groups. And the question we're asking now is, well, what makes for a group that's successful versus a group that's unsuccessful? Well, what we've done is we divided the groups, this is more or less arbitrary, into three different categories. The successful groups, they reduce the probability of catastrophe more than 50%. The intermediate groups reduce the probability of catastrophe between zero, some positive amount, but less than 50%. And the unsuccessful groups aren't able to limit the probability at all. And skipping over here, of course, the contributions are higher in these groups, as you'd expect. But the main point I want to emphasize here is the number of free riders. So we're defining a free rider as any player who contributes no more than five chips in the first contribution round. So you have five cheap chips. So these are costing you almost nothing. And what you need to do to avoid catastrophe is to contribute the expensive chips. And what you see is in the successful groups, there's virtually no free riding at all. There's almost none. I mean, the average number of free riders is less than 0.5 in the groups that with intermediate success. But in the groups that are unsuccessful, the ones that do badly, they have at least one free rider and often two. So what tends to happen is you have and this appears in a lot of experiments, you have conditional cooperators. These are people who are willing to play their part, do the right thing, as it were, provided they can rely on others to do the same. And what happens, though, is if there are some who won't do that, they pull down the others, and cooperation just collapses. Okay. Now, this raises the question, with the climate problem, do we have the right group? Because remember, we have this lot of variation. So maybe we lucked out, and we had the right group. Well, I hope I'm not bursting any bubbles here, but I don't think we have the right group. if this were just Scandinavia, we might be OK, but it's not. This is a very convoluted phrase here, but basically the International Energy Agency has taken the INDCs that have been supplied and their own projections based on published energy policies. And what they say is if the INDCs, these are the pledges, if they are carried through, which my work says won't happen, but if they are carried through, then you're only going to slow down the time at which we'll cross the threshold that countries have said we must not cross by 8 months. I mean, it's trivial. It's completely trivial. Okay. Now, this does raise the question, though, that's becoming quite a popular idea, club. You know, club, just the word club, it kind of makes everyone feel happy. And people like clubs. And it's new, and people are tired of the old names and labels, so let's try something different. And there's this idea, you know, why don't we just find the right group? So one notion of a club is let's find a number of like-minded, good people, conditional cooperators. We'll start with the Swedes, and maybe they get a few other countries to join in, and address the problem that way. But of course, what a club group does is it provides good benefits for itself. And what we have with climate change emission reductions is you have a global public good. So unfortunately, the group we have is actually 197 countries, and not all of which are the conditional cooperators. And they tend to drag everything down. So if the club approach is to be successful, there has to be some means for leverage so that the countries that want to move forward can somehow induce or coerce the other countries into wanting to move forward too. And I think, and this is, we're seeing this echo, it's coming, you know, around the room. Christian was just talking about this, Barty was talking about it before. I think there are only two plausible models. Now, so far, the only model people have talked about is Nordhaus. Funny enough, I'm gonna talk about myself. But I think the central problem always has been enforcement. Now, the Nordhaus approach is the group of countries will impose tariffs against others. And that, I think, is a provocative proposal exciting, but also provocative, because he's basically saying that a subgroup of countries can take away the benefits that countries have developed through the World Trade Organization if they don't participate in an agreement that the subgroup wants to go forward with. Now, there are certain conditions in which his approach and my approach, which I'll describe in a minute, are almost indistinguishable, and there are other cases in which they're quite different. The other point I want to make about Nordhaus, his analysis, though, is that he shows that this approach can support cooperation, but only up to a carbon tax of about, if I remember correctly, about $50 per ton. And to address climate change, it's almost certain we have to go well beyond that. So even this approach, I don't see as being sufficient to bring global emissions to zero. Now, the approach that I propose is to focus not on this problem as a prisoner's dilemma, a cooperation problem, but as a coordination game. So I've spent 2.5 decades trying to study international cooperation. What I've learned is one simple thing. Countries are very bad at cooperating for all the reasons we've seen here. They're very good at coordinating, very good at coordinating. And what we've tried to do is get countries to do what they're bad at. And what I think we need to do is get countries to do what they're good at. Now, there's one, I'll give you a clue, an example of a coordination treaty. There's actually one climate negotiation going on now that no one ever hears about that, in my opinion, will be the most important of all. It's taking place in Dubai in just a couple weeks. And it's a meeting of the parties of the Montreal Protocol, which is an agreement to protect the ozone layer. And they're going to negotiate amending the agreement to limit hydrofluorocarbons, which are one of the greenhouse gases. Now, that agreement, because of the way it's designed, is a coordination treaty, and that's the one thing that the world is good at. So I'm 100% confident that if they agree to this, that this will be successful. And my suggestion for the negotiations is that we pursue these other approaches. What I would not want to see is for us to go to Paris, let's say there is an agreement, and then spend the next 10 years focusing on whether countries are, whether you have all the monitoring and whether they're doing what they said they're going to do and all of that. We should do that. I'm not opposed to that. But what we also need to do is not look just under the light thrown by Paris and what's under the light, what we see, but all the areas in the shadows, because I think if we tried a different approach, we would have more success. That's it. Thank you very much.